Hey there, Kelly here. Guests on the show share so many great ideas, but how do you start putting them into practice? Well, that's exactly what you'll explore when you sign up for the Podcast Weekly Newsletter. Each week, you'll get 3 ideas from past guests sent straight to your inbox. You'll explore materials, techniques, tools, concepts, and mindsets in bite-sized pieces so that you can think about them and fold them into your own practice. It's completely free, and you get it by signing up at learntopaintpodcast.com/newsletter.
I just fell in love with painting. I mean, I didn't know that I was going to be an artist. It didn't occur to me that I was going to be a painter, or be an artist, or anything. I just knew I wanted to paint.
Hello, and welcome to the Learn to Paint podcast, the show that gives you artistic tools you can put to work. I'm your host, Kelly Ann Powers. Today, I'm talking with artist Jordan Wolfson. In the conversation, you'll learn how to get yourself familiar with a subject before you start your formal painting, how to match the type of painting you do to your energy, and why you may not want to search for your style, but instead listen for your motifs, plus a whole lot more. In the Extended Cut bonus, we get into self-talk and why it's so important to start enjoying what you're doing right now, no matter your skill level. You can find links to that bonus episode and show notes at learntopaintpodcast.com/podcast/episode95. I start the interview by asking Wolfson how he got started in art.
I was in high school. I was in a public high school, and it was a small school district. I was in 10th grade, and Lois Rosenfeld was the art teacher, and there were these oil paints, and she was old school. Like, okay, she showed us how to like stretch a canvas and gesso and all this stuff. And I was like, wow, this is great. So when I went to college, I was actually a bio major. I was pre-med, but every quarter I took a studio art class like for me. And eventually I just fell in love with painting. I mean, I didn't know that I was going to be an artist. It didn't occur to me that I was going to be a painter or be an artist or anything. I just knew I wanted to paint.
Was there a moment or moments, I guess, when you transitioned from doing this thing for you to sort of thinking like, I'm going to take this seriously?
Well, I kind of took it seriously from the beginning. Like it was a serious activity. Like, so when I was in college, there was my college curriculum. There were my college courses. And then there were my life courses. And it wasn't that I was doing it for me in some kind of just recreational way. I was doing it for me as a matter of living. I just kept following that. This is about my life. And when I dropped the bio major, and had that conversation with my father, right? And he was like, well, how are you going to make a living? And, you know, rightly so. Good question. And I said, I don't know, but I need to do this. And he was supportive. He really was. He didn't try to talk me out of it. He says, well, I'll do what I can to help you. It was always a serious thing for me. And then it was a question of, well, how am I going to make a living? I mean, that's been an ongoing question, actually.
You walked out of college with a set of skills. Were there still skills that you felt like you needed to develop even after that formal education?
Yes. That is, okay, as an undergrad, I even did a post-baccalaureate program for 1 year. So we each had our little studio spaces, and we painted, and we would meet with the professors. And so it was like consolidating and strengthening our painting practice. And I had teachers that taught me some real things about making a painting. This was UC Santa Cruz. But I felt like I didn't quite know how to be my own teacher. I didn't know how to continue to develop on my own. And I felt like I needed more of that input. And so that's why I went to grad school.
I think sometimes as a self-taught person, which is my background, you don't realize how much someone learns in art school. Like someone is saying, show up to this class and we're going to work for 3 hours and we're going to do it multiple times. Like, what did you walk out of art school, undergraduate and graduate, feeling like you had down that you could then build on?
A lot of things. But I also want to say I've talked to lots of people that got, you know, a BFA or an MFA, and they didn't get real nuts and bolts skills, and they didn't know, you know. So art education in this country has been a real mixed bag, depending on when you went to school, where you went to school. There's a great book called Art Subjects by Howard Singerman, who used to be in Virginia. Now he's chair of the department at Hunter College in New York. Art Subjects is about the history of art education in this country. Great book. But getting back to your question, I learned real hands-on formal things about how to work a composition, how to think about developing a composition, how to explore and experiment, how to make marks, how to take risks, how to draw, how to maintain a consistent frame of mind when I'm painting, how to find tonal relationships, how to think about what it is I'm doing, how to not make my work precious, very specific teachers saying very specific things about nuts and bolts that were both formal on the canvas or on the paper, things to do with tonality, geometry, things to do with composition, edges, but also the inner experiences, how to go for what's deep and real. What does that mean? How do you do that? And it wasn't whatever. There were real lessons that they gave around that. Of course, I was paying attention.
Well, we're actually going to jump into a bunch of that. But before we do, we're going to talk briefly about materials. You use oils. What does working in oils give you as an artist?
It's endless. It's changeable. It's versatile. It responds to my energy that I can work it thick or thin or delicate or rough. So it becomes this incredible vehicle for me experiencing my life while I'm painting. I get to go back and forth. I mean, some materials, you know, they're incredible, but they're trickier. Like watercolor is one directional, you know, I mean, but oils, you just keep taking that thing. You just keep going and going like life. It just is endlessly malleable and changeable and responsive.
How many colors are you generally working with in your palette in general? And what kinds of colors are those?
For many, 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 many years, my palette was very simple and limited. And I worked with cadmium yellow medium, cadmium red light, ultramarine blue, white. That was my basic constellation of colors. And then I would add, depending, you know, like, okay, let's stretch open my yellows and have a cad yellow light and an Indian yellow. So I'd have cool to warm to light to dark to transparent. I could do that. And so in the blues, it would be ultramarine blue. And then I would sometimes, you know, work with Prussian blue. Do I dare phthalo blue? Like sometimes, you know, depending on cost, cerulean or cobalt. But now cobalt, I think we all need to stay away from cobalt because of the mining problem in Africa. So cobalt, unfortunately, is a problematic mineral. But, you know, and so the reds too. And, you know, having that range from cad red light through medium and dark and then alizarin or quinacridone and sort of stretching open those. And then I stayed away from earth colors for a lot of years because when I was younger, it was a bit of a crutch. I would go to earth colors as a way of muting my color as opposed to using a complement to mute my color. And then everything would be kind of like ochre-y, everything, you know, and it was like, and it would lose its the possibility of some of the vibrance of light because I was muting with an earth color. Now, it really depends on the particular painting and what I'm after, whether I'm after that tonality and experience of light or whether I'm going after a more inward kind of response. But I need to say, honestly, I would love if I could continue to work with Old Holland Kremnitz White. It became prohibitively expensive. It's been a couple decades now, but it's just impossible. It's so expensive. But I think it's got to be the best white in the world. Flake white replacement that Gamblin makes, I like it.
Could you just talk to me about the differences between that white and then the other whites you might have on the market? What makes that white so good?
Well, Kremnitz white, particularly the Old Holland, it's stiff, but stiff like whipped butter, so that it's resistant, even a little more than whipped butter, but it's creamy. and it gives body to the paint. So it's almost like a relief sculpture when you work this stuff. And it doesn't really flatten. Like titanium can really flatten the vibrancy of a hue, you know, and everything gets kind of like pastel colors. And it doesn't do that. It's more translucent than that. It's just, it's a gorgeous substance. I miss it.
And it sounds like flake white is what you go to.
Well, yeah, because Kremnitz white is a kind of flake white, and it's lead. And so I'm going to a flake white replacement because Gamblin, it's stiff. It has a stiffness and a chewiness that I like.
How much variation is there between, let's say you're working within one brand of paint even, squeezing out different colors? Like, how much does the pigment in the tube affect the viscosity, the thickness of the paint coming out?
A lot. Whether it's a synthetic like ultramarine or alizarin crimson, you know, or it's a real mineral from the earth, like a yellow ochre or a burnt sienna. I mean, they're going to have different densities. The cadmiums are going to have different densities. And not just density of the material, but tinting power. So they're going to, you know, some are going to be like, bam! And some are going to be like, hello, I'm here. And of course, going from company to company, the same name of a color can be very, very different, right?
Do you add any mediums to the paint?
I do. I basically just use linseed oil.
What do you like about linseed oil?
Slippery. It's runny. It does stuff all on its own. It glides. So if I'm working wet into wet, I can use oil to lay something without pulling the paint that's underneath. It's wet. I can drop it on. It's like skating on ice as opposed to snowshoeing, I guess.
I've never heard that analogy. It's perfect. What brushes do you use and why those?
I use Robert Simmons Signet Hog Bristle Brights. Very specific. Sometimes I use different shapes and sometimes I use different brands, although not much. And I like the brights. Actually, when they're a bigger size, they call them broads. And I like them because I can kind of like slap paint on. I think there's something about, well, if I'm painting, let's say, more closely observed, observational, and I'm really trying to get a control of the still life and I'm rendering something, brights really do give me control that way because they're not as long as a flat or, you know, it's not that I couldn't do it with those things, but there's something about that short kind of shape that gives me more control with my edge. And then on the other end of things, when I'm like going more hog wild and letting it rip, using big brights or broads, it's more like landing a punch. It's like smacking it. There's something that's very, I can be more, in a way, I guess, aggressive in terms of the paint application. Whacking.
What surfaces do you use to handle all of this?
Yeah, right. Well, years ago, I lived abroad and I took with me when I moved abroad a big roll of cotton canvas. And there's a fellow I knew there who was a dealer. He sold a lot of my work. Anyway, one day he said, early on, he came and said, I've got this piece of linen I think you might like. And he gave me this piece of linen and I never went back to cotton. He was sort of, you know, like a dealer. So I really like linen. And I don't know exactly why it's so different, but my goodness, it is. And there's just something just, unfortunately, it is more expensive, but it's beautiful. And I used to prime my own. And then the kind of unprimed linen that I liked using, I could no longer locate. It was a Polish linen and it wasn't being imported anymore. And then I just went for another medium weave that is a one ply primed, oil primed linen by Claysons, number 66 Claysons. And it's expensive, unfortunately. So I wait till it's on sale. And over the years, it keeps going up, of course, like everything. But it's just gorgeous. And it handles the paint so well. It's like, the paint sits on it really nicely. I remember I was in a materials course. It was the last materials course taught by Bernie Chait at Yale. And he talked about Matisse, and Matisse's white surface. and how he prepared it, and that the way he painted, the way Matisse painted, it was really dependent on having that particular white surface underneath to come through the paint for that sense of light. So that, you know, a surface, just like everything, the surface is really important. It just really makes a difference. You know, there are some, I won't mention names, but there are some surfaces out there that are sort of like paint resistant. And they're awful. I have students, they bring them in and it's like, you know, they're struggling and they think it's them and it's not. And I say, oh, don't bring that anymore.
You know, listening to you talk, there's like a joy when you're talking about your materials. And how important is it to really enjoy like the materials themselves just on their own?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. We really need to. And to honor it, to honor them. Like, they participate. It's not just me. It's a participatory engagement. I mean, of course, we know I couldn't do this without paint, but it's like the paint is actively participating. I mean, that's a thing. Oils also, I think they have that. There's something organic about them, and they do. And the oil changes over time, and the oil is from the earth. A lot of the paint is earth. I think that really does make a difference. It's so, yeah, I love paint.
We're going to move into process. And you work in a couple of different styles, and we're going to get into all of that. But first, could you walk us through how you would paint a more realistic painting?
Let's say I'm doing an interior, and I will look at the interior. If it's something that's really unfamiliar and I want to have a long project, I might do some drawings first just to get to know the situation. What's my relationship to this physical situation? You know, if there are some chairs, and get to know the architecture of the chairs, their geometry, their angles, their relationship to each other, the spaces in between, to become familiar. It's not that I'm planning the painting when I'm doing the drawing, but I'm getting to know the motif. I'm becoming familiar formally with what I'm looking at. And I also am trying to become familiar with or discover what's my visual idea. That is, what about this situation am I interested in? Is it, if I've got like a director's chair, let's say, which I've used over and over, well, what about the director's chair? Is it central? Is it to the side? And is it the space? Is it how, you know? And so I don't mull that over beforehand. I discover it through drawing. And the situation that I'm looking at, how does it fit in a rectangle? And so that, of course, is composition. And so I'm becoming familiar with what kind of constellation, what kind of composition is going to work for me, which also, of course, means what kind of rectangle. Is this a square? Is it more horizontal? Is it more vertical? Is it more right? So I need to know, well, what is my visual idea and what kind of rectangle, the proportions of the rectangle are going to be most appropriate. Is it a 3x4, 5x6, 7x8? So all of that becomes really helpful to know before I go into a painting. When I go into a painting, it's not that I've planned the painting. It's more like I've become familiar with the situation so that when I go to paint, I can get some momentum as I begin. It's like, I know this is the appropriate size rectangle. It's a bear finding out midway, oh, you know what? I'm never going to get there because this is the wrong rectangle. It's like, So I'm setting that up and I start to draw with paint. I start to lay things out. This is over here. This is over here. Not in a particularly constrained way. It's fluid, but I'm located. I'm measuring. I'm putting things. I want this over here. So the space in between needs to be this. So I'm finding proportions. I'm placing things. I'm setting it up. You know, and I'm stepping back and I'm, okay, yeah, that feels right. Or, oh, no, that doesn't feel right. Let's go find that. And I go back in. Okay. And then things are more or less placed and I start laying in large tonal shapes, finding my key tonal relationships. So I'm using big brushes. So I'm not starting in with a smaller object and rendering it in a detailed way. I'm starting with larger shapes like the floor and the wall. And I remember first interior I did, and this was a residency after grad school. It was a large interior, maybe 4 foot by 3.5 feet, which I guess isn't really big, but for me, working from observation, it's not small. And I had a professor from grad school, a sculptor, we had become friends. And she said, start with the walls and the floor so that you really are building, literally building the setup. And then you put the, you know, and then when you have an interior, you can put things in. And I guess if there's a window, finding the relationship of the window to the wall next to the window, the frame, becomes key, because otherwise we're never going to have the window work as light coming into the space. And so all the value relationships get keyed in the interior to that first relationship of window to wall. So I'm looking for the big tonal relationships, and I'm working all over the rectangle, because not only am I trying to put in the big tonal relationships and get that set up for myself, I'm also trying to orchestrate how my eye is moving through the rectangle in relation to the four sides. So in that way, I'm like a great grandchild of Cézanne in a way, because I'm doing both, working in response to what I'm seeing, but also coordinating my visual circuit to the four sides of the rectangle and trying to weave those together. So that's how I'm setting it up.
When you're doing this sort of like the drawing and the composition, when you're familiarizing yourself with the relationships, is that all through drawing? Are you moving anything in your scene?
Yeah. It's like, oh, you know what? I need something over there. Or, oh, I'm going to move that chair. I had a particular setup of the chairs for many years. And eventually it was like last December, it was like, you know what? It's time to move the furniture. And it felt radical for me. But of course, all I did was move a couple of chairs. And when I did that, I had to, well, let's move, you know, and I'm starting up a drawer. No, got to move that chair. And where do I stand? And I need a bowl on the floor. So I put a couple of bowls on the floor. What about move this plant over here? And I'm, so it's a back and forth in relation to that. I remember I was in that post-baccalaureate program at UC Santa Cruz, and I was doing the self-portrait of myself. And the wall behind me was blank, so that in the painting, it was really hard to tell if what was next to my head was space, air, a wall. It was like, what is that? How far away is it? It was, you couldn't read it. And I had a teacher who said, why don't you put up like a postcard or something on that wall, just so you can understand where is it, what is it? It's like, oh, I can manipulate that. Oh, it's problem solving. Oh.
Right. You can change things.
You can change things, not just in the painting, but in the world. Like, you're solving problems. You're setting up what's going to work best for you to get you most in gear. What's your visual idea and how can you enhance it? How can you sharpen it? Problem solving, just like a carpenter. Problem solving.
So you work across many different styles. Where in your process do you decide what style? And if there's a better word than style, let me know. And then how does that affect your trajectory from that point?
Yeah, I understand what you mean by style. I tend to use the word mode or modality. Style, I think, can be a bit of a red herring. The word has a kind of external connotation, like, style is what other people may see about our work. But for us, if it's genuine, it's not my style. It's just what I need to do. And if I come to it with the idea that I'm looking for my style, I'm going to be coming to my own activity that needs to be welling up from inside me more like a spectator. And then I'm splitting myself. And then it's frustrating because it's very hard to stay genuine when I'm looking at what I'm doing and trying to make it fit into some idea of a style, because then I'm looking at myself from like a third person. So I would suggest people don't worry about style. Really leave it to someone else to decide if you've got style. You know, style is fashion. You go into a store, you put something on, the nice style. We don't do that for painting. It's not helpful. It's more like just the quality of our voice. You know it when you're speaking truthfully. That's all. That's it. It could be that I'm have a desire to really slow down, ground, take my time, work in a more contemplative way. And so painting from close observation, more in a representational realist mode really fits that. It's just more contemplative. I'm not in a hurry. It takes me, it just slows me down. for that right tonal relationship, like geometry, the edge. And there's something very, I find it very soothing. Of course, when I first was learning to do that, it was very, made me very anxious because it's like, oh my gosh, I don't know what I'm doing. That's not it. But as over time, it's like, oh, it's just lovely. Just, you know, and there's something about looking and being intimate with the very specific geometry and edge and tonal relationships. It's lovely. So it could be that I'm doing that, or even in drawing, or it could be that, you know, I am just brimming with energy. Maybe I'm exuberant, or maybe I'm just, I haven't been in the studio for too long and I just have to wield paint. I don't have patience to like stand, or I've been doing some representational work and I want to just break it all open. So part of the shifting of the different modalities is me keeping it interesting for myself. It's like, oh, well, let's do this. I haven't done that for a while. That's fun. Or what else? Oh, let's try that. And so I'm keeping myself engaged and interested formally. So sometimes when I start and I think it's going to be this kind of painting, I realize, oh, no, it's not. It's, it has to go that direction. And then I'll follow that. I'll honor it. So sometimes in the early part of a painting, it may shift, but generally it stays pretty consistent. And I tend to know going in what's going to happen. It's an intention. Oh, I mean, like, okay, this one's going to be more representational and I'm going to deal with the architecture of the forms and the light coming in. This one, it's going to look like a color field painting and I'm just laying lots of paint on in my experience of seeing. So sometimes when I'm making marks, it's not, the marks aren't describing what I'm seeing. Even though I'm working from observation, sometimes I am describing, but sometimes the mark is coming as a response, a trace, physical trace of my sheer seeing. I am seeing, I am seeing, I am seeing, I am seeing this, I am seeing this, I am seeing this. And with each experience of seeing, there's a mark. Seeing this, I'm seeing this, I'm seeing this. And those marks accumulate and they end up carrying energy because I am in them while I'm working.
How much of part of your process is really paying attention to what you feel like doing that day? And then how did you learn to trust that and to honor that? Because I feel like so often as beginners, we walk in sort of not trusting anything we're doing. We think like, okay, this is my goal, so I need to do this and this. Who cares how I feel? Like, how important is that to really train yourself to listen to yourself?
It's essential. There is no real activity without that. It will all be externalized and lack power. In order for our images, our objects, to be powerful, to be strong, to have impact, we have to be fully engaged when we're making them. Well, in order for us to be fully engaged, we must honor where we are when we're making. Now, that doesn't mean we don't learn our skills and, you know, learn to draw and to paint and to handle the materials, learn about composition, learn about the history of painting. All of those things are critical because they help us literally integrate our system. Through skill development, I am integrating my hand and my eye and my brain and my materials, my seeing, all of this stuff becomes an integrated unit. So my analytic and my intuitive and my emotional and my physical all learn to work together so that when I am honoring where I am, all my skills are with me too. So then I can move, I can adjust, there's an agility. And then also it becomes important through a process of there's skill development, and then there is becoming familiar with how do I want to work? How do I want to paint, right? Because it gets a little tricky when we're doing skill development, there are objective standards that we're trying to master. And so we are working with this external models of what we're trying to accomplish. And once we achieve that, we need to really start to explore, well, what do I want to do? And what really turns me on? Or what do I really care about? Or where do I live when I'm painting? Where am I? And who in the history of painting and who in the contemporary situation of painting, who do I love to look at and what are they doing and what are their questions? And, you know, and there's all kinds of ways that that can be, right? It could be straightforward representational. It could be from memory. It could be abstract. It could be political. It could be spiritual. It could be confessional and very emotional, whatever, right? There's a million ways to go, but I need to explore and experiment. And so I need to take lots of different kinds of workshops and teachers and influences. So I start to feel myself in different ways. And then over time, I start to become familiar with what's my truth here? Because if I can't be in my truth when I'm painting, it's okay. I mean, it is okay, but it won't be deeply satisfying. And it won't be deeply satisfying for others. Think about, you know, like who do we look at and we go, wow, that's, there's one thing when it's masterful and skillful. Okay, I can see that person really handles the paint. But then there's other stuff and it's like, I don't think about masterful. I just think of, it just blows my mind. It just knocks me out. You know, like someone like Soutine. I don't know if you're familiar with Soutine. 20th century, early part of the 20th century, first half, Soutine. He's working from observation. You can see, oh, these are dead rabbits or these are dead animal or trees or how, but the way he's working, he is so in the paint handling. It's just raw, amazing. He's an amazing, amazing painter.
Is that something someone has to learn, how to be present?
In a way, yes. It's not so much that we're learning how to be present. In a way, we're learning how to unlearn our conditioning. Because as we grow and develop as people in this world, we are learning, we are training our minds. We've got all these things to think about, and we're supposed to get good grades, and we're supposed to get a good job. I mean, all these things, all these conditions, and our minds are working all the time. And so it takes training to learn to come back to simply being here, simply noticing how does my body feel when I'm picking up the paint. And so there's all kinds of unlearning in a sense. Yes, but it's a training. I mean, even skill development, there's an aspect of skill development that is quite clearly a mindfulness practice. If I am learning how to draw this cup, at some point, my thoughts or all the extraneous stuff is going to stop because I'm really trying to see that friggin' ellipse of the rim of that cup so that it really does turn and I'm on it. And that's a mindfulness practice. I'm really present, right in my mark. And then it goes on from there.
For you as an artist, what does intention look like to you? And why is it important?
When I say intention, I mean, formally, what's the setup? What's the game? Am I going to work with, you know, closely observed geometry and tonal relationships? Am I going to allow this to be more open-ended in its surface and marking and more material? So what's my intention that way? But it's in the deepest sense of intention, I am interested in the painting embodying fullness, presence, a strong vibration, impact.
We talked about a more representational painting, but if you were doing something that was more about the line and the energy, how are you building that painting?
In order to go there, we start to listen or sense the energy of the painting, and it's invisible. So it's this odd combination. I am receiving the painting through my eyes, but what I am sensing is invisible. I feel it in my body. And one great way to develop that for our own work is by going to museums, sometimes great gallery shows, and standing in front of the paintings that just knock us out, and being there and receiving them and feeling them and getting to know them, draw from them. What that's going to do is we are calibrating our system, our mind-body system, to these paintings. Our system starts to feel, what does it mean to be with this vibration? What does it feel like? And then over time, we begin to have the courage and endurance and perseverance and need to do that with our own work. And it's like, oh, this is okay, but it's not enough. And this is some of what I got from my teachers, is the having the ambition, the audacity to go for great painting. We, each of us who have a desire to paint, we have the potential to make great paintings. But that takes real courage, because you really have to risk being yourself fully in whatever form that's going to show up, and honor it and keep going and really listen and be present and keep going and risk what's there. I've never been here before. This is really good. I really like it. But you keep going, because it's not great, or it's good and you put it to the side, and but you do another one and you go further. Then painting becomes an extraordinary adventure and a real gift for ourselves, for the world. I mean, it's possible. You could do this. The people that made great paintings, they're just people.
In your work, what is the benefit to coming back to a subject again and again and again?
Well, the first benefit is I don't have to think about, well, what am I going to do now? Because, well, it's already there. So part of it is, you know, I don't get a lot of time to fool around. I got to get in the studio and get to work. And it's like, well, I like the interior. or, you know, if I set up a still life. But also there is something that I really enjoy about just developing a relationship with it. There's a familiarity. There's a depth that keeps on going. And other ways of coming, of playing with it, other ways of exploring. It's known. And so I could go further. So there's an added depth. And then I really enjoy seeing the different iterations together. I like what happens when I go from this one to this one to this one to this one on the wall, and just seeing the way my mind shifts, the way my sensibility shifts. I find it interesting.
Does it help you be less precious as an artist?
Oh, yes, it must. But I mean, I want each of the images. I can't walk away from one of the paintings or drawings if it feels half-baked. So they all need to arrive at their own version of wholeness. But yeah, I certainly, they're not precious, no. But that comes also through just, you know, you keep drawing and painting, you got a lot of stuff around in the closets and garage and stuff, you know, it's like, well.
For someone who is interested in working across a bunch of different modalities, what is going to help them be able to move in all of those directions, especially if they're coming from the starting point of being more of a beginner?
Well, yeah, play, really play. And you could just also could say, okay, literally write it out for yourself. I'm going to do this that way and this that way. Think about, I've got these four or five painters that I really like. I'm going to do this in, you know, in this person's style. I'm going to do this in that person's style. You could just make up games. It's like, could be like a checkerboard. It's like sometimes we play checkers and sometimes we play chess and sometimes we make up games. And so you could just decide formally, I'm going to try it this way. I'm going to try it that way. I'm going to put on classical music. I'm going to put on jazz. I'm going to put on punk, metal, just shaking it up for yourself to end up working in just different ways and playing. And it's like, am I bored? If I'm bored, what can I do to make, you know, what else can I, how can I make this fun?
You've said this a couple of times. And so how important is it to do something formally, to write it down, to sort of say, this is what I'm trying for this, and this is what I'm trying for this, and it's different?
It can be helpful to help us clarify for ourselves what we're doing, why we're doing. When I first started to paint, I thought painting was all about being spontaneous and intuitive. And yeah, that's an important part of it. But there's also the power of the analytic and the power of the self-reflective, and not to lead the situation, but to support, to assist, to be a help, to serve it. And so, yeah, to reflect, what am I doing? What do I want to do? It's a helpful thing.
How important is it as an artist to feel free, but almost especially when we're learning to paint, like that feeling of freedom?
I think it really depends on the individual. I've had students like in the foundations, and we're learning, you know, foundational skills of drawing and painting, working from still life, working from observation. And some folks, they really enjoy it. And for other folks, they're just like chafing at the bit. It's like, oh, I hate it, you know. And it's really important that they also have another arena where they're working, where it's more of a free-for-all, and they don't have to measure, and they can just mark, and they can look, and they can respond, and they need that. And so it really depends on the person's temperament. Every formal medium, music, whatever it is, everything needs limitations in order for us to explore form. We need limitations. And so same, right? What are the parameters? What are the limitations of this? But we're all different, and we all have different relationships to these limitations in different ways. And so it's really important to understand that. I think we all need our skill sets, but you know, some folks are going to experience freedom in different ways. We all need freedom in the work, but what that's going to look like is going to be different for different people.
For someone who really is chafing at the sort of formal foundational drawing value, for them, do you still suggest that they like spend some time working through that, but then not all their time because they would give up painting because they'd hate it? But do you still encourage them to spend some time trying to build those?
I do, because it does lead to a deeper integration of our system. And it also leads to a feeling of confidence, self-confidence, mastery, strength when we're working. And it also leads to an ability to come to a two-dimensional surface, the paper, the canvas, and enter it as a spatial experience, so that when we're marking, we're not marking on the paper, we're marking in the paper. We're painting inside that canvas. There's this three-dimensional experience that we are experiencing while we are marking, so that the two-dimensional and three-dimensional are occurring at the same time. And that, I believe, is really essential to the power of painting, that those things are happening. Now, that said, there are people who don't have any formal training, and they just make what they make, and they're in it deeply. And it's just powerful. It's just how it, and we tend to categorize that as outsider art generally, but people are just, they're just deeply in their work as they're going, and okay. But generally, most of us aren't that, and we need to strengthen and integrate. And yeah.
What are those? And I really am just asking for a list. Like, what are those foundational things that someone might benefit from learning?
I would say being able to look at simple objects and draw them in with a line in a way that is convincing, proportion. They're in space, they sit, they're in relation to each other, they're in a consistent space together. If you can do that with a figure, that would be even better, because if you can do the figure in a way that is convincing, you can really draw pretty much anything. And in particular, if you get the head in relation to the torso, that would be really, really good. Tonal relationships, being able to mix. So with tonal relationships, I mean, you know, getting the value and getting the how saturated versus how muted, putting those colors together in a way that creates a convincing sense of form and light. That's good. In relation to that would be edge quality. So how does one shape meet another shape? Is it a hard edge? Is it a soft edge? And in line drawing, that's line quality. How hard, how soft? So controlling the materials in that way. And then how do those shapes fit, and the placement of shapes in a rectangle? So we're talking about composition and understanding how to relate to the four sides, so that my drawing or my painting is not just a study in the rectangle. It is the rectangle. My painting is the rectangle. So how does that work? And then I would open it up as well and say, it's really helpful to explore non-representational painting. And what does that feel like? What does it feel like to court accident, make a mess, throw around thick paint, try different media, you know, different kinds of cold wax, stand oil? How does all this work, right? And how do I organize chaos? How do I play in chaos? What does that feel like? It changes our relationship to the material, so that when I, no matter what comes next, I have a very different relationship. I'm not as timid. I would also say that becoming familiar with the history of painting, past and present, to some extent. And what are they doing? What are their questions? How do they work? Why do they do that? So that's sort of like this grounding of a world.
Every once in a while, I am just in awe of how much there is to learn And awe is the positive side. The negative side is sometimes overwhelm. So if someone hears that list and thinks like, nope, that's too much, because overwhelm is part of this.
I would say, don't think that just because you're developing your skills and becoming familiar with the world, that you can't make great work. You don't have to wait. Just be where you are. There's this wonderful line, I think it's in The Art Spirit by Robert Henri. And he says something like, be a master of such that you are now, have now. And then later on, you'll be a master of whatever more you acquire and gain. It's an inner position. And you could make masterful work as you develop your skills. Just be really present and know that this is yours. You're doing it because you desire to. You're doing it because it makes you feel alive. So enjoy that. Be that. Don't worry about getting ahead of yourself. It's not like you got to do all of this stuff and then you're going to really do it. No, you do it now.
Also, with that entire list, I imagine that even as long as you've been painting, you're still making discoveries across that entire list. So it's never ending, but like in the best way.
Yeah. There's this, Bonnard says something like, you know, that, you know, one is always a student, something like that. You know, so as we develop, we become our own teachers, but we do that so we could also stay student. We're asking questions, we're exploring. Otherwise, why? I mean, I suppose some folks are just making a good living and okay, and they're just fine. But I mean the real stuff. And it's like they're exploring. So the position as student is real.
So often the advice painters, especially early in their painting journey, hear focus, focus, focus. Like you got to focus down to get good. Focus on a subject, focus on a style, focus on like narrow down.
That could be helpful for sure in terms of getting skills when you're, you know, if I'm learning to draw, I've got to focus. If I'm learning to mix tonality, you know, color, I need to focus for sure. In order to start to acquire skills, I need to focus. But I would say after I've got my skills, it's really important to break it all open. What's out there? What are people doing? What have people been doing? And start to explore. If you can get two or three teachers that you really connect with and they contradict each other, that's really good because it forces you to figure out your deal in all of this. Now, once you're on the trail, what's the, like you're hunting and you can smell, you something like that, you know, like go for something and like, what's your project and go in there and really try to work. But that could take years of exploration. Don't be in a hurry. This is a life thing. I mean, it really is. It's a life thing. It's a way to live life. It's a way to explore life. But, you know, we do need to learn to focus. I mean, we do live in a world that is working to scatter our attention all the time. So yeah, we do need to focus, but I would say that's part of one of the skills.
We talked about a lot, we're at time. I wanted to check with you to see if there's anything we didn't cover that you wish would like us to.
Well, I touched on it a bit, and that has to do with engagement, deep engagement. I believe what makes a painting work in the final sense, what makes it powerful, what makes it real is the depth of our engagement when we're working. Presence gets embodied in the object. We know this when we step in front of a painting that really works for us. The thing just has presence. Well, how did that happen? What is that? And how do I do it? Can I do it? Maybe I can do it. Wow, maybe I can do it. So how do I do that? So what does it mean for me to be deeply engaged in my work? So that's key.
When you're talking about the deeply engaged in your work, I'm really struck by how that takes a lot of bravery, because it's one thing to know that we could work harder and there's like a safety in that, but to say like, no, I want to show up in a genuine way. I want to push my work as far as it can go. I want these things. Feels so vulnerable.
Yeah. In order to do that, I have to be vulnerable. I have to take risks. I have to not know what I'm doing. Because if I stay in control, well, it just stays in my wheelhouse. But there's no real life going into the work because life is open. Life is unknown. And so it takes a kind of becoming comfortable with the uncertainty, becoming comfortable with the doubt. The doubt doesn't go away. Matisse was full of doubt. Giacometti was full of doubt. Cezanne was full of doubt. They don't know. We look at it and we go, oh, they sure knew. That's not what they experienced. And so what does it mean for me to go there? What does that entail? Yeah, it is scary. One of my teachers, Andrew Forage, he said, paint with courage. That's not just a glib. That's real.
But also, I feel like I hear that and I'm kind of encouraged because what it means to me hearing it is that, like, yeah, I feel scared sometimes. And that means I'm doing it exactly right.
If you feel the doubt, the uncertainty, the confusion, you're on the right track.
If someone came to you and said, I want to get really good at painting, what advice do you give them?
I mean, where are they in their development? Where are they in their journey as painters? So I would need to know where they are. I mean, get your skills and explore what's this territory, then find out what you really love and care about when you're painting. Nourish that, honor it inwardly and outwardly in the painting, and discover who you are as a painter.
You can learn more about Jordan Wolfson at his website, including his workshops, at jordanwolfson.com and on Instagram and YouTube, and we'll link to everything in the show notes. Thank you so much for being with us today, Jordan.
Thank you, sincerely. It's a real pleasure, Kelly.
That's it for today's show, but there's more great conversation with Jordan Wolfson's Extended Cut bonus. In it, we get into self-talk and why it's so important to start enjoying what you're doing now, no matter your current skill level. You can find links to everything at the show notes at learntopaintpodcast.com/podcast/episode95. Thank you to everyone over in the Podcast Art Club. You make this show possible. Extra shiny thank yous to High Gloss supporters, Andrew Atterbury, Debbie and Brian Miller, Rihanna DeRold, Janet Wheeler, Nancy Bryant, Pam Lyle, and Slow River Studio. Happy painting!